This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today is about teachers. Later in the program, we hear from the co-founder of Profound Gentlemen. That's an organization working to attract and keep black males as teachers in the classroom. First, North Carolina's Teacher of the Year. That would be Bobby Kavnar, who teaches British literature in the Gaston County School, specifically at South Point High School. He's been there for 13 years, a teacher, I believe, for 17 years, and he joins us in our Spirit Square studio this hour. Bobby Kavnar, welcome and congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
In addition to being North Carolina's Teacher of the Year, you are North Carolina State University's Inspirational Teacher of the Year, Gaston County School's Teacher of the Year, and the 2016 Southwest Region Teacher of the Year, and a it's embarrassing, isn't it?
Yes.
And a five-time recipient of South Point High School's Most Inspirational Educator Award, which is given by the students.
That's right. That's right.
What's your secret?
Boy, I wish I knew. I wish there was something I could bottle and or train every teacher in North Carolina with that one thing. But the truth is, teaching is dynamic, and it changes moment to moment and kid to kid, and it's not a standardized, bottleable, teachable thing. It's something that is artisanal. Teachers are artists, and we have to invent it as we go. And so, you know, every year I'm sort of surprised they like it. I mean, every single year, because I love it. I teach Shakespeare, and I love Shakespeare. It's what I did my master's degree in. And every year I'm shocked that they like it too. And I think it's because I love it so much, they see that and they react to that.
Well, I was going to ask, you teach British literature, and Shakespeare is one of the things that you teach. It's not a subject that a lot of high school kids would normally gravitate toward, but I think you're also teaching advanced placement people. Is this something that comes naturally to you? Does your ability in the classroom come because simply you want to share the material, or you're so excited about this particular material that you teach? Could you teach American literature and be as excited about it, in other words?
I think so. I mean, when I started teaching, it was the material that brought me to teaching. I loved literature. I was excited about literature, and I wanted to share that excitement. But, you know, I've been teaching 17 years now, and 13 doing the same subject. And so I've taught Macbeth hundreds of times.
Right.
And so it's no longer just the material that gets me excited. Rather, it's the kids. Seeing them come to it for the first time reminds me of how excited I was seeing it for the first time. And so that's what keeps me in it, is coming back day after day and seeing those kids experience this for the very first time and experience Shakespeare for the first time and have that love that I saw.
You used a word when you were talking about what teachers do in the classroom I've never heard used with regard to teachers, and that is artisanal. Do you think most teachers feel that way about their jobs?
I think good teachers know it. What artisanal means to me is that when I walk into a classroom, I can feel whether my lesson plan is going to work today or not. I can see it in their eyes. I can see how fidgety they are. I can see, you know, I know what happened earlier in the day. Maybe prom's later, you know, maybe there's a pep rally they're particularly excited about, and they're just different that day than they are any other day. And I feel that, and it's an art form to know, okay, this plan I had is not going to work. I need to change this. I need to tweak this or tweak that or change this. And that's what I mean by artisanal. When you get an artist who is incredibly good at their craft, they can feel, for example, the wood and know where that soft spot's going to be and how to work around that.
It's like a performer, a live performer.
It is.
You feel the audience.
You feel the audience, yeah. And every lesson is a performance. I do three 90-minute performances a day, and based on my audience, I have to know whether they're getting it or not. And you can see that in their eyes when you've done it for a while.
Does that come intuitively to you? Does it come from experience? Was it taught to you in teachers' college? Observe it in teachers that you had along the way?
All of those things, yeah. I had great mentors. I had great mentors who came in and gave me real feedback. But also, you fail a lot as a teacher. You fail every day, and you learn by that. And you practice your craft. You see, okay, well, that lesson really didn't work. What was wrong with that? Maybe you need to toss it. Maybe it just needs to be changed a bit. But good teachers are artists. And, you know, while I say that, half of it is also preparation. Good teachers work, and I work. I make lesson plans, and I do research, and I'm always learning more.
You stuck with it for 17 years. I think, what did I say, 13 at South Point High School. A lot of teachers don't make it beyond the first couple of years, or a lot of teachers just kind of drop by the wayside as time goes on, because you are mistreated in the world today, which we'll talk about, it seems to me. So what has kept you at it? Why do you stay? Why have you stayed?
That's a question that I often ask myself. Year after year, you know, you'll get offers when you've taught for a long time. You get offers to leave the classroom or, you know, work for educational advocacy or move up, become an administrator. And that's part of the problem, is that there's no growth in teaching except to get out of the classroom. Some people think of teaching as an entry-level position, and you need to work your way up by leaving the classroom and becoming an administrator or moving into the central office or things like that. But the truth is, the way I see it, our kids need smart, talented, qualified, licensed, hardworking people in the classroom.
But you're throwing yourself on the barbecue pit to do that. Seriously.
I don't think so. I mean, I know we like to see ourselves as martyrs or saints or, you know, sacrificing ourselves. But I don't see it that way. I see teaching as something that I'm good at, that I love doing, and that I'm willing to do. And so it's a career that's fulfilling to me. I find it deeply fulfilling in a way that no other job I've ever had has been.
Many of the North Carolina Teachers of the Year, and I'm sure this is the case around the country because every state has a Teacher of the Year, and then they compete in this National Teacher of the Year competition.
Right.
But I think many of the North Carolina Teachers of the Year who spend the next year out of the classroom doing the grand tour of the state and
talking to
teachers and talking to administrators and talking to legislators and other people who influence education don't return to the classroom after
that.
Yeah, they get scooped up by other entities. What's your plan?
My plan is to return to the classroom, but, you know, that's what they all say.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough. It is very tough when you have this reach when you're in the classroom, you know, and they say teachers touch eternity. You have this reach where you're reaching kids. I teach around 200 kids a year. And so, you know, after 17 years, I've taught thousands, you know. And so I have that much reach, and I can influence those kids. And I hope my reach goes beyond that, where they take the things I teach them. And it's tough, though, as a teacher who cares about education, when they offer you a bigger reach, right? This year, I get to sit.
And a bigger salary?
Well, yes, and a bigger salary as well.
Mm-hmm.
But this year, I'll get to sit on the state school board. I'll be superintendent advisor. You know, I'll be traveling and talking to teachers all over the state. And that's a big voice and a big reach. And when they say, hey, you could keep that and influence, you know, the 1.4 million kids across North Carolina, That's tempting for a lot of teachers.
Have you spoken to people who have won this award previously about whether or not the fact that they sat, for instance, on the state school board for a year and influenced those decisions for a year really had any long-lasting impact?
I have. Keena Triplett, who is the current Teacher of the Year, and James Ford, who was the teacher of your two years ago, and I believe was on this show.
It was.
They both have talked about the way it completely changes how you see education. It's an eye-opening experience to be able to see that level of education, that level of policymaking and influence, that they really do see the way the classroom works differently. And I don't start until July 1st, and so I'm really looking forward to that and seeing sort of the larger picture of North Carolina education.
Just as I think it's true in most professions, but most professions are not as visible perhaps as teachers are. But the people on the front lines are not always consulted about policy changes and about what's going to happen next. And it's the people on the front lines who really have an intimate knowledge of what's right and what's wrong and what's going on.
That's true.
And could, if they were consulted, perhaps have a much more positive impact on things.
That's true. Now, I think also you know, we as teachers need to stand up for ourselves and speak out. And I think now we have sort of an opportunity to do that with social media. Social media allows individuals to have a much bigger reach, as I've been talking about, than ever before. And so through things like Twitter and Instagram, Facebook, all those things, teachers can speak up and can
But don't you put your job in jeopardy if you speak up too much and it's going against the policy of the county or the policy of the state or the policy of your individual school?
Well, I think there's a way to do it that's respectful and that's fact-based and that's professional. And I think as long as you're those three things, professional, fact-based, and respectful, no, I've never seen any reprisal or pushback. In fact, most of the people, at least in my county, my principal, my superintendent, the people on the school board, are glad to hear from teachers. They want teachers at the school board meetings because you're right, we are the front line. And often big ideas that come from, say, the federal government, by the time they trickle down to us, can be very warped and very different than what the intention was mm-hmm. when we go to implement them. And so it's good for teachers to speak up and say, hey, this is the reality in the classroom, and give that message back to those people who make those decisions.
Do they listen?
Yes, often. You know, and that's something we have to help them do. You know, they have a lot of other influences speaking to them besides just teachers. There are for-profit companies that are getting into education in our state. There are companies that are opening for-profit schools. There are companies that want to sell us all sorts of materials. And policy changes are good for those people because they get all new materials and all new books. And so that's a lot of power and a lot of influence and a lot of voices for people making those decisions. And so if that's all they're hearing from, then that's all they know. And so it's important for teachers to speak up and to be an advocate for teaching.
You have just or will shortly speak to a bunch of first-year or beginning teachers.
Yes, yeah, I spoke to them yesterday.
And I know that you conduct a model classroom. You give a tour of a model classroom to beginning teachers every year out at South Point High School. Is that something you took upon yourself, or did they ask you to do this? And is a model classroom? What does that tour look like?
We have a program called TIPS in Gaston County. It's a teacher induction program where we train new teachers to our county. And one of the things we do for them is bring them through several teachers' classrooms, an English teacher, science teacher, a math teacher, and show them how our classrooms are set up, you know, why they're set up that way. Because a classroom does more than just house desks. It is first, it sets the tone of your class. My classroom is very unusual. It's modeled after a Victorian library. There are antique clocks and beautiful pictures and big old furniture. And it's even got a giant lamppost in the corner straight out of, you know, C.S. Lewis.
And you do that because? Yeah.
I do that because it sets the tone of my room. When the kids come in, they know that my space, this space here that we're going to share, is an academic space. It's a serious space. It's a space for thinkers and for scholars. And so they come in, and as I say to them, we're going to join the club of literature. And, you know, the club is open for membership, but you're going to have to pay your dues. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to buckle down and read. And it's going to be work. It's not all beauty. You know, there's a lot of work to understand the beauty. And so when they come in there and they see a room that is for adults, you know, they take on that persona. It's like putting a kid in a suit. Suddenly,
if you raise expectations, they will rise to meet the
expectations. I believe so, yeah. And now your classroom is also a management tool. My classroom is set up so that it runs with me or there or not. The kids know how to turn in assignments, what to do with late assignments, where to sign in and out, where the hole punch is, where the pencils are. The room runs by itself, and that allows me to concentrate on teaching. And so if you have a well-organized classroom that can run by itself, you can have a big impact on your classroom management.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I want to ask you if that style of teaching could be applicable to all other subject matter. We'll come back in a moment and get an answer to that and many other things with Bobby Kavnar, North Carolina's Teacher of the Year. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Steely Dan with guest Steve Winwood Saturday at PNC Music Pavilion, Charlotte. Tickets at livenation.com. Well, it's been another unsettling year economically. 2016 began with economic caution and murmurings of a possible recession. Stocks were all over the place. Then the stock market appeared to be on an upward trajectory until Brexit hit, the British exit from the European Union. That's roiled markets erasing almost all of this year's gains. So what do economists see for the rest of the year? We talked to two of them and the banking reporter for the Charlotte Observer coming up on this program tomorrow at 9.
On the next Ian Rehm Show, many undocumented immigrants are living in fear after a Supreme Court ruling effectively barred deferred deportation for 4 million people. What the ruling means for families across the country and how immigration policy is playing out in 2016 election politics.
The Ian Rehm Show this morning at 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Bobby Kavnar. He's the North Carolina Teacher of the Year. Takes office, if that's the right word, in July.
Right.
And he teaches British literature at South Point High School in Gaston County. That's in Belmont. And he's an award winner on so many different levels. You were talking about how you set your classroom up and how it's a special place and it's designed for adults, essentially, and the kids don the persona of an adult when they walk in the door, and great things are expected of them, and they rise to meet expectations. And you've decorated it like a Edwardian or a Victorian library.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Could that style of teaching, not you wouldn't want a math class to be decorated like a Edwardian or a Victorian library, but could that style of teaching be applicable to other subject areas?
I think so. It's one of the reasons we show them my classroom, but also we show them several other classrooms that are very, very different than mine. Like I said earlier, teaching is not something you can standardize. We can't say, do these six things in your classroom.
But that's what we've been trying to do now for 40 years.
I understand that, and it is not the right way to go. Teaching is as individual as our kids are.
And teachers keep saying, I know I have a friend who was the Mecklenburg County or the Charlotte Mecklenburg Teacher of the Year, and he was in the classroom for, I don't know how long, but a very long time, 30, maybe 25 years, and he just finally said, you know, that's enough. Because I can't do what made me the Teacher of the Year anymore. I can't do it because they won't let me do it anymore.
Yeah.
So why don't they listen to teachers? When teachers are saying to them, you can't standardize this. It has to be individualized to our style of teaching, to who is in front of us in the classroom, responding to their individual needs.
Right.
You can't standardize it. And yet they ignore you. Why is that?
Well, yeah. To be honest, it's because it would be cheaper to standardize it. The truth is, to do what I do, you're going to have to hire committed, educated, licensed, talented people.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Absolutely not. But those people have lots of other opportunities. And so you're going to have to pay what similarly degreed professions
get paid.
But
are they paying you that?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
But say, for example, you want to be
there?
A teacher. Well, what keeps me there is a very, very big thing, and it's something that my father taught me when I was a kid. My father explained that when you're born into a nation like ours that offers all of these opportunities, and when you're born into a family that has the privilege of putting you in good schools and feeding you and dressing you and has all of these wonderful things, it's your moral obligation to give back, to pay back that society so that society continues to be great. And so my whole life I've been told it is your obligation to pay back society. And so I thought about that my whole life. I thought about, well, how do I do that? And I've said this many times, but one of the things that I talk about in my platform is this promise of equal opportunity. There is a promise. It's written into our founding documents. It's dreamed of in the Declaration of our nation that each of us will get an equal shot, that we're all going to get a fair shot at life.
Mm-hmm.
That's the promise of America. It always has been the promise
and
of America.
And do we provide that in the public schools in America?
That's what I believe. You're supposed to get an equal shot, but the truth
but
is, of course, life isn't fair. Well, life
you're
isn't
in
fair.
You're in Gaston County schools. They're
right.
Different from CMS. Do we get, and I don't know if you can speak to CMS or whether you want to, but do we give kids of different socioeconomic backgrounds an equal shot, or do we shove some of them off to the side?
Not yet, we don't. But that's why I stay. You know, you've asked me why I stay. And the truth is, I stay because people need to. We need to give them that fair and equal shot. And public education is the one way we can make the world fair.
Well, public education has come under a lot of attack in recent years. And not only attack, but they're searching for alternatives to public education, vouchers for private schools, the allowance of more charter schools, which are funded with public education
That's
money.
Right.
But don't have the same rules attached. So are there forces at work that are deliberately weakening exactly what you're talking about?
Yes. In short, yes. But that doesn't mean that their heart isn't in the right place.
Okay.
I'm not so cynical that I believe there are people who want to hurt children. That's not the way it works. But I do believe...
I don't think they want to hurt children either.
I do believe...
I think they want to hurt the public schools.
Right. But I do believe that their heart is in the right place, that they want to do what's best for kids. And it's what they're thinking is, well, you know, let's try this, let's try that. And they're trying, you know, privatization. They're trying charter programs, voucher programs. They're trying these things. In my opinion, that is not the correct.
But they're trying it because there is this perception, and it could be an accurate one, that the public schools are failing us.
I've heard that before, and I'm always shocked when I hear that. The public schools are one of the great successes in our nation's history. Think about, for example, in 1970 in North Carolina, only about 15% of people had a college education. Now we're over 65%. The public schools are a magnificent success.
So why are we trying to find alternatives?
That's a great question. I think the perception is that the public schools are failing because you've heard that. You've heard that phrase. Public schools are failing.
Where's that coming from?
Well, they'll say things like, oh, well, you know, when we compare ourselves to China, well, we're doing something that no nation in the world does. We educate 100% of our populace all the way through high school. There is no nation in the world that does what we do. We are an unbelievable success as a nation. Look at our country. And so we'll hear we're failing, but the truth of it is that if you look at the history of American public education, if you look at where we came from in the founding of our country, there is nothing as successful in America as public education.
Mm. The other thing that, aside from standardized testing and many, many, many tests throughout the year that we've been doing and trying to find alternatives to the public schools, there's been a push in recent years in education and in government circles to get kids ready for jobs, teach them what they need to know to be successful in the workplace. You teach humanities. You teach
Yes.
British literature.
Yes.
How is that helpful to that end? And is there a force working against your ability to do that because you're viewed as not as important, perhaps, as a math teacher or a science teacher, a STEM teacher?
Right. And I have no doubt that STEM is important. Science, technology, engineering, mathematics are all fantastic. They're wonderful degrees. And you're right, there are jobs in those. But think about how you become a leader. The way you become a leader is often by speaking to people, by building relationships. Good leadership is about building relationships. You know, Keena Triplett, the last teacher of the year, was also an English teacher. And you wonder, well, how did they rise to that? The way we rose to it is because we write well, we speak well, we can talk to people and build good relationships. But the best leaders are the ones who understand the humanities, the one who understand about relationship building, about the power of spoken words. Think about how we choose our president. We choose our president through things like debate.
Right.
We don't choose our president based on engineering. We choose people who are good with words, who know how to build relationships with others and work with others. And I think that's where the humanities...
And who can analyze things.
And who can analyze.
And that's what you're teaching.
Yeah. And I think the humanities does that. And so recently there's obviously been a big push for science and math. And I think that's a good push, that we need those people. But we also need people who understand the words, the English, who understand the power of those things.
And in a literature class, because I've taken a few as an English minor in college, you have to be able to discuss the work that you're reading. You have to be able to analyze it. You've got to be able to pick it apart. You've got to be able to make logical conclusions from one thing to another. You've got to be able to compare and contrast. You have to be able to write essays. You have to be able to write essay tests, but what we've moved toward is ABCD.
Yes.
Testing. Yes. How do you use the skills that you teach in that class and test it to see that it's taken hold? How do you do that?
It's very difficult. There's a wonderful book called Measuring Growth in English that discusses exactly that. It was actually one of the books that inspired sort of the SAT and how do you measure growth in English. And the truth is that growth in English is very, very slow, that you can't measure it over the course of, you know, 18 weeks. Mm. The ability to write well, for example, is so, to use the word again, artisanal, that it is something that develops over years of practice. And you don't see growth from week to week often. What will often happen is you'll see growth where a student learns to write the way you want them to so that you're happy with their writing. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're now a good writer. They've just learned whatever rubric you're using. And so that is, of course, the great, great challenge to the humanities is how do we grade them? How do you grade chorus, art, band? You know, those are the things that are very, very difficult to score. But one thing that I've said is that just because you can't count it doesn't mean it doesn't count. The fact is that we don't have to count everything we do to know that it's important. We don't have to measure chorus to know that it builds confidence in children. We can feel those things, and that's where the humanities come in, is we need to be able to feel rather than always want to count.
Bobby Kavnar is the North Carolina Teacher of the Year from South Point High School in Gaston County in Belmont. You teach advanced placement literature. You teach British literature. We've had a lot of discussion about reading skills in the lower grades. When these young people come to you in your classroom, and you're probably teaching what, juniors?
Seniors.
Seniors.
Yeah.
Obviously, you're getting the cream of the crop. Are kids coming to high school prepared to read at the high school level?
That's a difficult question because what the high school level means is very debatable. The fact is that in the history of American education, going way back, literacy was all that mattered. You know, you said, well, you want them to be able to read and write and then go get a job. And now we're asking for something much bigger than basic literacy. We're asking them to read ancient documents. We're asking them to read treaties from the 1700s. We're asking them to analyze Oscar Wilde. And these are the skills that our standardized tests are based on. The passages on my test are from Oscar Wilde and treaties and things like that. And so what we're asking them to do is bigger than what we've ever asked them to do before. And so that's where they look and say, oh, well, you know, your schools are failing. And we say, well, you got to give us time to raise the standards up to that level of rigor. But we also need to question ourselves as to why every kid needs to read at Oscar Wilde levels, for example, and maybe think about, which is what Gaston County is doing in my county, think about focusing a lot more on skilled trades. We need skilled trades in North Carolina. And so we've opened up what we're calling a STEAM Academy, where kids can learn a trade and maybe learn reading that is more practical for them if college is not the direction they want to go. But what we need to do is, as North Carolinians, is look at our kids and let them know that that's not a failure. Going into a skilled trade is not a failure. That college is not necessarily where everyone needs to go. That being a welder, a plumber, an electrician, those are wonderful, fantastic, and also necessary and respectable trades. Mm-hmm. And that a skilled tradesman is in no way any less important than a college professor.
Are we sending that message or are we not sending that message?
I think we're getting there. I think there is a push now where we are seeing academies specifically for tradespeople.
Right.
And we are seeing a sort of
shift. It's kind of a throwback that used to be done regularly.
I absolutely think so. I think what's happened is that we focused so much on college because we realized that we aren't a nation of manufacturing anymore. And so we said, well, people need more education, which is absolutely true. For the jobs that exist now, you do need more education. And so we focused so much on college that we sort of lost track of our tradesmen. And we told kids who weren't college bound that somehow that was
a failure. And I think that was a terrible mistake, and we need to change that. But one thing we need to remember, though, is that 65% of the jobs that a student starting school today will have don't exist yet. And so we're trying to prepare them for something we can't possibly imagine. And that's why I think it's important to teach them to think rather than teach them a job.
You teach, as you said, Shakespeare, but you also teach Shelley and Byron and Dickens and Coleridge, etc.
Everyone, yeah.
And this is a Twitter world we live in of short bursts of text and a celebrity culture that really doesn't remember what happened yesterday because we've moved on to the next Kardashian scandal or whoever's the person of the day. How do you make these people, these writers, and the way they write relevant to young people?
It's amazing. It's always been a Twitter world. It's always it's always been the Kardashians. The truth is, Shakespeare had his own Kardashians.
Yes, he did.
You know, and it's always been that world. Sonnets that I teach were originally part of what they called manuscript culture, where celebrities up in the court were passing gossip back and forth between each other, writing them in sonnet form. So they were short little bursts, 14 lines, and sharing them with each other. So the truth is, the world hasn't changed that much. It's just a matter of making it relevant to them, showing them what's there for them, but also you have to teach people to slow down. You have to teach kids to think deeply and to take time and to read deeply. And that's very rewarding, but also very, very hard.
Is that why your students say that in addition to teaching English, you also teach them life lessons?
I hope so. I hope so. But also, I teach something every year that's become wildly successful. It's the one thing that parents most talk to me about. I teach one day of etiquette in my class. I teach things like tying a tie and pulling out chairs and, you know, offering your arm and not to wear white socks with your tuxedo and those
Why? Things. What has that got to do with English?
I saw a need. And you're right. It doesn't necessarily have to do with English, but that's not my only job. My only job is not just to teach them literature. I'm supposed to teach the whole kid, the whole child. And I saw a need at my school. I chaperoned prom, and I saw a need, and there are a lot of kids at my school who maybe don't have a father figure at home. And so I said, well, someone needs to father these ones. And so I took them under my wing, and I did it just as a half-hour thing once in a class, and I started getting emails from parents going, thank you so much. Thank you for teaching them that.
Why didn't the parents teach that?
I don't know if they knew that that was a need they had. You know, it's tough as a parent to know everything your kid needs. And sometimes other community members, other adults, you know, they say it takes a village, and I think that's absolutely the case. And what ends up happening often is if a parent tells them, the kid doesn't listen. That, you know, it's your parent. It's tough when you're a teenager. And so your parent tells you one thing, and then a teacher tells you, and you think, oh, well, that guy knows what he's talking about. And the parent's thinking, that's the same thing I told you. So I'll often have parents email me and say, will you tell them to do such and such? Because they won't listen to me, but they do nothing but talk about you at home.
Wow. When you hang it up, when you retire from teaching, whether you're 65 or next year when you've decided that this Teacher of the Year thing is a pretty good gig, what do you want to look back on as your greatest achievement?
Wow, that's a big question. The truth is, I hope I made...
Have 30 seconds to answer.
Well, now it's a bigger question. The truth is, I just hope I made the world a little bit softer. The truth is, we're a little too hard. We think too much and we feel too little. We're trying to count everything. And so I hope I made the world a little softer, a little gentler, and maybe make people feel a little more.
And not wear white socks with tuxedos.
That's right.
Bobby Kavnar, British teacher at South Point High School, North Carolina's Teacher of the Year. Congratulations and thanks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Cherokee NC's outdoor drama, Unto These Hills, inviting listeners to see the story of Cherokee's history nightly at 8 p.m. except Sundays. More at visitcherokeenc.com. Many undocumented immigrants are living in fear after a Supreme Court ruling effectively barred deferred deportation for 4 million people. What the ruling means for families across the country and how immigration policy is playing out in 2016 election politics. The topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. Our conversation today is about teachers and teaching, and we'll continue in that vein in just a moment. Stay with us.
This week on Morning Edition, we hear from people across Europe and the United Kingdom as they move closer to a divorce.
All my fears basically have just come true. All my paranoia and skepticism about this country, based on this vote, is true.
Also this week, President Obama sits down for an interview with NPR News. Listen every weekday morning.
Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE and at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. There's been a lot of talk in and around Charlotte about keeping teachers in the classroom, especially African-American males. Research suggests that students of color perform better academically and are disciplined less when they have teachers of color. Nationally, African-American male teachers make up a mere 2% of the workforce. In Charlotte, the number is about 5%, and that is why Mario Jovan Shaw and Jason Terrell founded Profound Gentlemen, to attract African-American men to and keep them in the teaching profession, in the classroom. Co-founder and director of development for Profound Gentlemen, Jason Terrell, joins us now for the rest of the hour. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me again.
You're welcome. Both you and your co-founder came into teaching through Teach for America, I understand.
Yes.
What attracted you to that program and to teaching in general?
So coming out of college, I was a double major in African-American studies, political science, and I minored in philosophy. So I had intentions to go to law school initially, but I always found a passion working with students, whether that was either through my community at home back in Atlanta, Georgia, or just on my college campus. My passion wasn't in law. It was really in kids and teaching, but I didn't really have an avenue to express that because I wasn't a teaching major. Mm-hmm. I presented with Teach for America my senior year while interning in Atlanta. For an after-school program through the Urban League, and decided to take advantage of that opportunity. I was placed in Charlotte, which was my second choice, which was amazing.
Your second choice.
Atlanta was my first choice, so Charlotte was my second choice, and I came to Charlotte in 2012.
But both you and your co-founder, Mario Shaw, as I understand it, graduated from the Johns Hopkins University School of Education. Is that right?
Yes, for our master's, yes.
For your master's degree.
Yes.
And now you've both started this program. Are either of you still in the classroom?
We're both not. And so that's because we won a fellowship. The fellowship that we won, it made us dedicate a certain amount of time for a Profound Gentleman. So it's a 2-year fellowship that we've won in 2015 that helped jumpstart our organization and gave us that seed funding and that initial push to go out and make this a nonprofit and expand our work nationally.
Why are you needed? There must be a need that you saw. Why are you needed?
So we're needed for multiple reasons. I think the best story I can tell is as a 21-year-old going into the classroom here in Charlotte, there wasn't a lot of black men in my school building. I taught in a predominantly African-American school, but the lack of teacher diversity in the school building wasn't reflective of the student population. Had a lot of students came to me and almost looked at me as a father figure, as a 21-year-old male, asked me things about life, asked me things about relationships, about academics.
What grades were these? What
I was 8th and 7th grade.
Okay.
Here in Charlotte. So I have, from 12 to 15-year-olds were kind of my age group. And one thing I noticed is that was a lack across the board, across a lot of schools here in the county. But on the national level, there weren't enough men in these lives of kids on the academic level. So they didn't have opportunities to see reinforced images of success. So we thought we had a definite need to be one young African-American men to one try to figure out how we can one attract men into the profession, but also figure out how we can keep these guys invested in the profession so they can stay long term, because we know there's a need.
Well, you're out of the classroom now because you're running this organization that is geared toward attracting African-American males and to keeping them in the classroom. And our previous guest, Bobby Kavanaugh, mentioned that there is no path for advancement in teaching other than moving into administration or other areas of education. If you're a teacher, you're in the classroom and you're there for the rest of your life. How do you keep ambitious, good people, black, white, Asian, whatever they may be, in the classroom?
So there are a lot of different models that, you know, for instance, Project Lift is trying a model called Opportunity Culture, where they're paying teachers an additional stipend to take leadership roles within their teaching profession so they can stay teachers but attain these different leadership roles. I mean, even in Profound Gentlemen, we actually pay teachers to lead our sessions. So we almost incentivize the profession by giving teachers an extra salary, extra stipend, just to say, one, you're appreciated, but two, we value and recognize your expertise and how, you know, that expertise can extend beyond the classroom setting. So I do think there are models and there are opportunities to really value and incentivize and really uplift teachers who are currently in the profession to ensure their work is valuable.
According to your website, if I read it correctly, only 2% of educators in America are male,
right,
and only 65% of those who are male will remain an educator after their third year, while 95% of women stay. Why? What's behind the exit?
So there's three reasons that most men of color leave the profession, and actually pay is not the one of the top three, which was very kind of surprising for me. The first reason is something called professional care. The idea is that most men of color feel burnt out. There's a recent article by the Secretary of Education, John King, about this idea of something called the invisible tax. He argued that men of color in school buildings have an invisible tax because they almost have to be almost like the answer for their race, so to speak. And most of our K-12 schools, boys of color are performing well, but they are performing marginally low compared to their white counterparts and their female counterparts. And oftentimes, black men have to almost step up and be the voice for that. And he argued that invisible tax keeps a lot of men essentially out of the classroom or feel that sense of burden.
Did you feel it?
I did, definitely. Having the opportunity to teach my scholars was a great opportunity, but having to almost be the disciplinarian and having students from I'd never taught before come to me and always kind of come to me with their problems, I definitely took that on as a responsibility. But that also was an additional tax on me as well, because that wasn't, again, my main responsibility.
But is there not a reward for that? I mean, if people are coming to you, they're coming to you out of respect and need.
Right.
And they're asking you for advice because they see you as a role model. They
right.
see you as a father figure. They see you as a teacher. And isn't that what you got into the business to do in the first place? So if they're asking you questions outside of your subject matter,
right.
that's a sign of real respect and need. Why isn't that a reward as opposed to a tax?
So it's 100% a reward. But I think also with the additional stresses that come with being a teacher, having that additional almost like tax of being one of the only men of color in the building, having to represent not the race but represent boys of color is very taxing.
So a woman mm-hmm. or a white woman or an African-American woman would not have that same set of responsibilities, that same tax, to use your word?
No, they might have the same, but the thing is that there might be multiple black women in a school building. There might be multiple white women in a school building. There
so
might
the,
be only
so
one.
The more the merrier. The more black men in the classroom, the easier it becomes for each individual African-American man to be in the classroom
right.
because they have a support system.
That's all it is.
Because they, like the students, need somebody to go to as
right.
well. And you can't go to female teachers for support or for help or advice?
No, you can. You can go to anyone for support. But there's also this thing about just that brotherhood and camaraderie that comes with identifying with someone.
We didn't talk about it with Bobby Kavanaugh, but on his blog, he's written about how teachers are isolated mm. from one another because they spend most of their day with students, people much younger than them that
right.
they're trying to teach. And you say that black males leave teaching because you just talked about it, because they feel isolated.
Right.
They have no one to turn to.
Right.
Is the only answer to that bringing more African-American men into the classroom?
One is bringing more African-American men in, but also connecting them with a network of existing African-American teachers. That's what we do. We try to figure out how we can connect African-American men who teach around the nation together so they can share resources and build community with one another.
So where did this idea for Profound Gentlemen come from, and why the name?
So it came from started here in Charlotte. When we first started in 2014, it was a group of maybe 10 teachers, all black men, and we would get together maybe monthly just to do dinners and just to build community with one another.
Mm-hmm.
That group grew from 10 to 20 to 50. And right now we reach over 500 men of color around the nation. But it started here in Charlotte very organically.
And how long ago was that it started?
2014.
So it's been 2 years, a little right. less than 2 years. And you've already gotten 500 people, and you're in multiple cities
right.
around the country. How has that happened? That seems really fast.
Because there's a need. There's no network or conglomerate of men of color in teaching. Period. So there might be networks and groups for other races and communities, but for black men there was none. So we essentially filled that need, and we were able to grow very rapidly from that. And we call them profound gentlemen because of this idea of the profound additional impact. Now, we believe that all teachers may have, you know, make great impact on the lives of students, regardless of your race, your color, your right. demographic. A good teacher is a good teacher, yep. period. But we believe that having a man of color who is also an exceptional teacher, you do have a profound additional impact on some of your boys of color and your students of color because of that relationship and that identity piece.
A lot of people, and you point this out, I think you had your first African-American teacher when you were, what, a sophomore or a junior in college?
And I
remember being shocked when I walked into a classroom in high school and there was a guy, just a man,
right.
standing in front of the classroom. I thought, oh, wow, men can be teachers? Who knew? And so this is a double shock for a lot of kids because they've never seen an African-American male
right.
in a teacher in a classroom. What does that mean to those students who finally see somebody like them who's also male?
Oftentimes, when we think about media and the images of black men aren't always positive, mm-hmm. especially what you hear through the news or through music. And so some of our students internalize those images. So when they are presented with a positive man who's consistent, who carries himself, as a professional, because that's what we are. We're professionals. I think that definitely has an impact. As you mentioned, they can aspire to be that. So we have this theory in Profound Gentlemen called you can't be what you can't see. So if they don't see
it. You can't be what you can't see.
You can't be what you can't see. So oftentimes when you don't see positive images, if you don't see the teachers in your life, in your community, how do you aspire to be that?
You have to see possibilities.
You have to see that. And that's all it is providing opportunities for students to see those possibilities.
But, we have a black president.
Mm-hmm.
We have some, not many, not enough, leaders of corporations who are African-American.
Right.
We have all kinds of African-American politicians and sports stars.
Right.
Why aren't they showing the possibilities? Are they? But just in a different way?
I think they're showing in a different way, and not to discredit any of them.
Sure.
But I do think there's a difference between being able to touch something tangibly versus being able to see maybe an image on television for 30 minutes. So having the opportunity to talk with one every single day is a little different from, seeing the president or seeing.
Because you're not just seeing a guy whose skin is the same color. You're actually picking that person's brain,
right.
hearing how they think, what they feel, what their reaction to you and your behavior is, and what's acceptable and what is not, and inspiring you to learn because I could be like him.
Right. Also, the opportunity that, a lot of, I share the background, the demographic, a lot of my students, both racially and socioeconomically.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm able to kind of communicate some of the things that I went through and how that related to them. So we have that, again, that shared commonality.
Your goal in Profound Gentlemen is to retain male educators of color at a 90% retention rate.
Right.
How do you plan to do that? That's a really ambitious goal, given what we have in the classroom today.
Right. So our goal is a three-step process. The first process is this idea of community building. We believe that in order to keep teachers invested in the classroom, you need to feel connected to a broader community, to have that sense of accountability with one another. The second one is opportunity of peer development. So we need opportunities for teachers to be developed not only by themselves, but have additional opportunities to experience professional development as well as a development around your identity, around your culture. And the third opportunity is this idea of career building and career opportunities. So we believe that we provide gentlemen with incentives, with stipends. We have clear avenues for upward mobility within the profession, but opportunities for them to become leaders and step up to the plate. We believe that they will feel more invested as well in that profession. So we're going to.
But when they really get good at this, and because mm-hmm. you always come in as a beginner, but mm-hmm. when you really get good at it and you begin to get noticed,
right.
the way up is to become vice principal or principal or something else higher up. How do you keep these people in the classroom if they're really good at what they do and they're having this impact on kids? They still have to live. They're still individuals. They
right.
still have ambitions and needs.
And so our theory of change is that we provide something called a cradle-to-career pipeline of professionals. So we don't have just teachers in our organization. Around 77% of our guys, 77% of our gentlemen are teachers. But we also have school leaders. We have counselors. We have gentlemen in nonprofit and policy. Because we believe we want to provide something called a cradle-to-career pipeline. So every time a male of color or students of color matriculate throughout their K-12 experience, they'll be impacted by a male of color.
You are, you keep using the word gentleman. And I think that's because it's part of the title of your
right.
organization, Profound Gentleman. And I asked the question, I don't think I ever got an answer to it. Why the name? What are you trying to say through that name?
Oh, well, the name came from this idea of, again, of the profound additional impact. So we'll begin, profound is this idea that gentlemen are, they have this additional impact on the lives of students. So we believe that all teachers, all, you know, male of color in our organization, they're profound gentlemen. They have this profound additional impact. And gentlemen is just the title because that's, we're professionals in, in the field. So it's just a way to kind of highlight the professionalism.
Why aren't they getting what you're providing within their own social networks, within their own school system, or within their own schools? Why aren't they getting the support they need, the rapport they need with other adults, other teachers? Why do they need you?
The idea is that oftentimes, just like students, oftentimes your teacher development is also standardized, so it's not really individualized. So it's almost like this one-shoe-fits-all approach when it comes to developing and retaining teachers, and that doesn't work for all teachers. So we provide more of an individualized approach for a specific demographic.
And you've also said that you can help, your organization can help with promotions for black male teachers that will yield higher-paying jobs so they can remain inside the school. How do you do that?
So we partner with school districts, school networks around the nation, and they offer essentially career opportunities to gentlemen, either within the school or either within the school through an academic context or even a non-instructional position to move up that ladder. So essentially, we found that there's a high need for schools for men of color just to increase their teacher diversity. So we have a great platform because we have the pool of teachers who can connect.
Among the promotions that you mentioned is recommending these people to assistant principal and principal positions. But when you do that, you've taken them out of the classroom.
Right.
So you're working against yourself, aren't you?
No. So again, this idea is that we want to essentially provide avenues to keep men invested in education. We don't want to lose, black men out of the field of education. Even if they move into a principal position, they're still impacting the lives of students, maybe not as directly as a teacher, but in the capacity because they're still tangible. But we just don't want to lose these guys within the profession.
We only have a couple of seconds left, but your outreach has expanded tremendously in the first couple of years. As you said, you've gone from, 40 people to 500 people in several cities around the country. Have you been, it's maybe too soon for these metrics, but are you finding that you are successful in keeping young black men in education and attracting them to it?
Right. So we've done currently right now this summer, we're kind of closing out of our surveys, but based off our mid-year surveys, right now 80% of our gentlemen said they'll be returning back to the field of education next year, which is a great win for us. We're trying to beat that up to 90%. So that's the first win. The second win is we are attracting men into the profession. We have, men literally contacting us every single day saying they want to be teachers, how they get into the profession.
What's your website?
Profoundgentleman.org.
Okay. Jason Terrell, Director of Development. Thanks.
Charlotte